The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Hey guys, it's Andy coming to you from the porch of a local coffee shop, The Buzz in Hendersonville, because they have power and internet, and I do not. So you're going to hear a lot of noise during this intro because I am outdoors because I brought Greg. And as you're probably aware, they don't usually let cats inside places that serve food. So we're hanging out on the porch. He's chilling in his backpack. I'd get some noise for you, but you know, he doesn't really meow on command. Okay, so I have a couple brief reports from everybody concerning their state of affairs. I don't really know what order to go through them in, so I'll just kind of do them the order in which they came. Sorry, there's going to be a lot of noise in this intro, but see, the reason I'm letting a lot of noise be in this intro, it's for Rick, so that when you hear the actual episode that Rick recorded, you'll be like, man, Rick really did an amazing job. Okay, so Teezy's an interesting one because she's the furthest north of us. She's actually in Asheville, so she's closer to all of the worst hit parts than I think most of the rest of us are. I don't know where Rick lives now. I've not been there, I don't think. So, but it's, I think he's still outside of Asheville and maybe not on a river. At any rate, okay, so Tiziana says that her and the family are doing fine. They got mild damages to the property and no injuries. Power was out for 7 days and the internet 8, but both are back now. I do know she's in the part of Asheville that does not have water and is trying to prepare for not having running water for an extended period of time. So that sounds like a pain with two children and, you know, four people in the house. Apparently her neighborhood's real super chill. Everybody's been really good to one another and working together to make everything work. So good luck. And let's see. Sarita is a bit south of here. Edgerton family had a massive tree fall, but no damage. They were without power for a week and they still don't have internet. Rick. Mr. Welch. The Welch family had no damage to their home and are all safe, but did have to cut their way out of their driveway through fallen trees. Oh my God, the amount of trees that are in the way. Although it was really neat when you were traveling around like right after the storm cleared and the skies turned blue, I hopped on my bike to see if I could get across town. The answer was no, I could not. I was trying to see if I could see my parents who I had limited contact with because of spotty text service. So I knew they were okay, but I wanted to get over to the house because, well, I'll tell you about it afterwards. Okay. Welch family, they had to cut their way out of their drive. Yeah, I was talking about how many trees were down and make it passable with their tractor from where water had formed a 3 to 4 foot deep by 6 foot wide gully down and across. It sounds like a little washout there. Well, not a little washout, a washout. As of Sunday evening, there was still no power or internet in their community. Yeah, they don't have. I wonder if they're on a well. Hopefully they have water at least. Billy. The Kimsey fam is all safe and homes are too. Power is back on now. The sawmill, however, his business, is damaged completely. This is a super bummer. All electric motors, electrical boxes, tools, computer, chainsaws, paperwork, and some equipment have been underwater. They're cleaning the sand out of the motors to see if anything will start and run tomorrow. That would be today as of my sitting here and recording this. Thankfully, all family and loved ones are safe and well. And Andy, little note to me, your cherry lumber that I had drying for you has floated off. Well, Billy, next time, I guess I should buy lumber from somebody that's a swimmer. Is that a good joke? I don't know. I was trying to work out a joke for that. I had a couple, but we'll go with that. Ralph Hicks. Okay, we are safe. I just finished cutting the last of the trees, and we just need to stack and get repairs done. I suspect that is a typo, and I don't know what quite it's supposed to mean. Hold on. Oh, Rick. Oh, I was going to say Rick. Ralph has a whole big one he sent to me independently. Okay. I think they were a little more in it, as TZ was probably the most in it by location. At 5 a.m., I woke up to the sound of rustling leaves. I looked out the window. Ooh, color commentary. I looked out the window to see one of my trees being shaken back and forth like a rag doll. I woke up at like 4 a.m. listening to that, actually, and I just decided that I would be powerless to stop it and I should go back to sleep. He went to his back door, opened the door, and looked out. He could see many trees leaning and heard several of them fall, which probably was quite startling. One of which landed on his neighbor's house and went through the top floor. At 7 a.m., five or six trees started to fall in the backyard. It was at that moment he finally decided he should check on everyone in the house. Everyone was okay at his house. At 7:15, he went out back to check on the damage to the house. He heard a crack of a tree, so decided wisely probably to go back inside until it was safe. At 9 a.m., trees three and four of the six that landed on his house fell against his bedroom wall as he was talking with his wife. I did not know this. We are finding this out together. Holy crap. That is harrowing. Terrifying, certainly. After that, I went through the neighborhood making sure people were safe. The neighbors and I spent the next 2 days clearing the trees from the road so emergency services could come in. That was a nice thing I saw traveling around was, you know, groups of neighbors all getting together and clearing their roads and neighborhood. Power went out just before 5 a.m. and didn't come on for 4 days. Water was out for 5 days. They're still on a boil order as of him writing this. All of my neighbors are safe. We lost 3 houses in the neighborhood. Youch. And several more were damaged much more than mine. As of this morning, I have finished cutting the last of the trees, and all that is left is to stack the wood and have the repairs done to the house. Yeesh. So that is a... I think it is safe to say that is far more eventful than anybody hoped for. I don't see a blurb from Rick Carter. Suffice to say that he lives a little further out and probably is got less of the storm because of his location. Let me double check. Okay, no, I don't see one from Carter. Though he's fine. I know he's fine. And I assume maybe because of his location that he probably didn't get it too bad. Although it was a storm, certainly. Okay, and me, my house is fine and the studio is fine. We're on, day 9 without power, though. We've had water the whole time, thankfully. Really grateful for water, running water, even without the power. So there's a lot of, take all your devices up to Main Street where there's a bunch of outlets on the planters that everybody's been sitting around and charging up on Main Street. Of course, internet and stuff has been terrible. It's just starting to recover right now. And so there's this children's museum on Main Street that had Starlink. So you could just go and hang out in that children's museum and use their internet, which was super nice of them. Actually, it's still true, I'm sure. So everybody was going up to Main Street to charge and the Children's Museum to get internet and start getting in contact with people before that was possible to do any other way. So that's been, a lot of it's been good in the way that people in bad situations are actually super nice to one another. I love that. It really... it makes me feel good about people. I like people. I've always liked people. I've never been the negative sort about that. Well, truck. I've always thought people were essentially good, but, it's really nice to see it happen. Everybody got to meet a bunch of their neighbors they're not used to talking to. Everybody did that neighborhood thing to a lesser or greater extent where, y'all helped each other out and stuff like that. Of course, I say that, and having had it pretty easy in Hendersonville. Relatively, there are, of course, some parts of Hendersonville where are below a floodplain or stuff like that. And there was massive flooding. A couple trailer parks near me, small trailer parks near me, are both low in a floodplain and often flood, but of course did it worse this time around. But we don't have the river running through town the way that the places that were worst hit did, right? So what happens is, of course, the storm system moved so fast that it still had a lot of energy when it got here. It moved very quickly over land. And, you know, when these things get pressed up against the mountains, it just literally squeezes the rain out of them. And then the rain came back down those mountains and filtered into the rivers and stuff. And that's where that flooding came from, was it was just the whole basin coming down into these rivers at the same time and just destroyed. I'm sure you've heard maybe about Chimney Rock and Black Mountain and Swannanoa. I'm trying to think of the, these places were devastated. Like I've never seen, I still haven't seen it with my own eyes. I'm down here in Hendersonville. And honestly, for a while, it was hard to get news from across town. But from what I've seen, I've never seen anything like it in my whole life. Places just by the river, just torn up and gone forever, probably. It's devastating. So I didn't want to talk about how nice everybody was without acknowledging how completely terrible and destroyed some places are. It's, yeah. Where was I? Okay. So me personally, yes, did quite well. We had nothing happen on the property, thankfully. Still no water. I mean, we have water, no power. Mom's house, my parents' house, that was why I was trying to get across town. So my parents' house had a tree fall on it, just like crushed in the front of their living room. And they had two trees fall on their car. So they got hit pretty hard, man. They're okay. They're still at the house because part of the house, you know, there was an addition that's kind of like a great room. That's what they really sit in. They never actually spend any time in the living room. And their bedroom was okay, and the kitchen is fine, and the great room is fine. So they've been staying in that way that sometimes old people do when it's hard to get them to do the thing they need to do, which is at this point is leave. Because I don't think they're going to turn the power on to her house until the repairs are made, but she thinks she might be able to finagle it, so we'll see. Eventually, I suspect they'll have to find some place to go, and I'm just hoping she doesn't put it off so long that we can't find her one. So I gave them my car. I've been biking all around town. That's kind of been what I've been up to, which is good for me. I work at a desk. I've enjoyed every minute of it, honestly, the biking. Well, that's the short story. Yeah, a lot of dealing with insurance and FEMA for everybody. I feel like most of us here, greater or lesser extent, have had it pretty good, though, when you take into consideration the absolute devastation that some places have seen. So, thankful. Everybody seems healthy. There's a new buzz that I swear wasn't in this microphone a second ago. I guess that's what I get for recording outdoors, isn't it? All right. Well, I hope the noise isn't too bad. I hope it doesn't drive you nuts. So moving on, I hope everyone enjoys. This is when Rick was in a place. He was definitely in a place. He was talking to Tim Martin. And we really hope you enjoy this conversation. We hope everybody is happy and safe. And their microphones aren't randomly misbehaving. Thank you, guys.
Well, I am coming to you live from the chicken coop in Whitehall, Montana. You're going to hear, it's going to sound, I'm going to move this out a little bit. It's going to sound like we are on a farm with some bulls in the background, a little echoey here and there. You might hear some sprinkler systems. You might hear some chickens. But I am here thanks to Tim Martin, who brought me here to sit down with him as well as with Steve Magua this week. So welcome, Tim Martin, to the Burrows of Berea.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you coming out and taking advantage of it.
Yeah, and if you guys hear my mic messing around, I don't have my trusty sound engineer, Andy, so there's going to be some echoey to it. Sorry about that, Andy. But here's what I'm going to do for Andy. I'm going to hold, and we're going to be quiet for 15 seconds, okay? And then he can take out all kinds of hisses and stuff.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is a third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly, and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
That was funny. So, Tim, we're just going to kick this right off, okay?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
To the best of your ability, can you tell me the earliest memory that you have of when you heard the name Jesus Christ?
I remember probably 6 or 7 years old climbing up in the bed with my parents and praying the sinner's prayer. And before then, I've heard the name Jesus Christ at all times. I grew up in a Christian home. But that was my first memory of it getting real to me. And on my parents' bed.
Wow. So where were you at that time? Were you in Montana, or where were you?
I was actually in Panama City, Florida, as a youngster. My parents were teachers at various Christian schools all over the place. So yeah, it was a good memory. It was I was raised in a Christian home, so I never remember a time when I did not believe the gospel as I understood it. From youth, as you know, the story of Timothy is in the book of Acts, when Paul talks about, you have known the scriptures from youth to make you wise. Mm. So that's kind of my background.
Yeah. So always hearing it. Yeah. That's incredible. I think I'm getting this echo simply because of this table. It's kind of reverberating. So I'm going to see if I can turn a little bit here. I don't know what's going on. Sorry about the echo, guys. It is what it is. So take me from there. So you're 6 or 7 years old. You've been raised in a Christian home your whole life. So where you are today, I know there's a big journey here, and I'm excited to hear about how that happened.
Sure. So my grandparents and my parents go way back with Bob Jones University. And
that's down in my neck of the woods.
Independent Baptist movement. My grandfather was involved in leadership with Bob Jones University with their missions program. For a while, he was president of their Gospel Fellowship Association, which was the missionary wing of Bob Jones University. So going back to the 1950s, my grandparents were on the mission field doing the whole dispensational thing of preaching the gospel to every nation and bringing in, you know, the end from that paradigm of futurism. And my parents were on the mission field as well. My dad was born in Curacao, which is one of the ABC islands off of South America, where the ministry was. But both my parents graduated from Bob Jones University with education degrees. So they went into Christian education. And I grew up as a young person in Christian day schools for a while. And then they got involved in the homeschooling movement as I was a little bit older. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with an education background, they were very interested in that whole movement from the 1980s on. I remember when homeschooling was illegal in a lot of states.
Yeah.
Basically, underground and have your plans about how to get out of the house and escape and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was my background. But, you know, as a youngster, they took me to the mission field. We were in Brazil I was like 2 or 3 years old. And they told me I should be dead.
Really?
sitting on a front porch of a little hut, you know, upriver, up the Amazon River by boat for a day or so from any nearest town. The mission with the Indians there, you know, they had to catch all their own rainwater, and they had little generators they could run for like an hour or two a day for power. Mm. But they had these water barrels on the front porch, and I had this toy sailboat that I was playing with as a 2-3 year old kid, and they were busy doing something else or tending something else, and I went head first into the rain barrel.
Whoa!
Like as a toddler.
Oh.
And in God's providence, apparently I was not meant to be dead at 2 years old. A little Brazilian Indian girl walked by, a little bit older than me, and grabbed me by my feet and pulled me out.
Wow.
So
you're saved by one of the...
There's a little Brazilian girl out there, a little bit older than me. If she's still around, I can thank for, wow, for being here. It's kind of an interesting story, but that was life on the mission field in the Amazon rainforest.
So that's wild because, you know, I've heard of, I think it's, was it Elizabeth Elliot, I think, was one that her husband was in, right, that same area, wasn't in...
I think that was Peru.
Oh, was it Peru? Okay, yeah.
So. Yeah, there's a number of different fields down there. But the idea was you had to get the gospel to every tribe and people, mm-hmm, so that the end would come. Matthew 24:14.
Right.
That's the whole mission focus. Global missions movement was really kind of steeped in that idea. So they were doing Bible translation with the Indians down there, with the native Amazonians. And they worked with the different mission groups that were involved. But it was all Bob Jones sort of funded and organized.
And that was what year?
In the 80s? that would have been like late 70s.
Late 70s, okay.
Right.
Right, because you were a toddler. That makes sense. Yep. So, all right. So let's say after that point when you're in the Amazon, you come back to where in the States?
So my parents taught at Christian schools in a number of different places, from Virginia to Florida. They were on the Big Island of Hawaii at a Christian school for a while. And we spent most of the time in North Florida. Then we ended up in South Carolina. I got exposed to different ways of thinking at one of the schools that they went to, which was a Presbyterian school.
Okay.
So I was first introduced to sort of Reformed theology from that exposure, because it was a Westminster Confession of Faith, PCA type of church, mm-hmm, day school. So that opened up some horizons, and I'm only like at 15, 16, 17 years old. But it sort of opened up some ideas that were different.
Did you talk to your parents about that?
We were all talking about it among ourselves, and you know, there were some questions about our history and heritage in the Independent Baptist theology going on at that time. Mm-hmm. I think partly because my parents wanted to be more culturally involved, and in that fundamentalist world, it was about saving souls as, right, opposed to political activity or cultural endeavors. And so that was sort of a family gradual move in that direction toward more Reformed thinking, Calvinistic theology, because of the environment that we were in. And ultimately, for me, as a teenager growing up in it, I was always kind of the book nerd anyway. So I was reading lots of fun stuff that, you know, my parents were interested in, but they didn't really, they were too busy with their responsibilities anyway, mm-hmm, of being school teachers in a Christian day school. And then, of course, homeschooling, that they didn't really get into the nitty gritty. So it was more like a trend, a family trend. And, you know, after that, as a teenager, you know, they were very, very influenced by James Dobson, Focus on the Family. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that James Dobson talked about in the early 80s was a group called Summit Ministries in Manitou Springs, Colorado. Mm-hmm. It's a Christian worldview camp. They had a lot of political connections. And so they thought it was a great idea to do, you know, Christian worldview ministry would be like the cool place to send Tim and the other kids at the appropriate time. So I went out to, David Noble was the president and founder of Summit Ministries in Manitou Springs, Colorado. And I loved the whole concept of, you know, taking Christian kids from Christian backgrounds, you know, teach them about Christian worldview so that they're prepared to go to college and defend the faith and everything. And that was the first experience I had, that first camp experience, where I was introduced to a lot of different denominational backgrounds. I mean, everything from Pentecostal to Wesleyan to Presbyterian, a lot of Baptists, you know, a lot of Charismatics. We were all thrown together in this Christian worldview stuff. And I loved it so much that I ended up working at Summit Ministries for 3 summers.
Oh, wow, okay.
Following that. So it was like kind of like a political, cultural, Christian worldview ministry. And I just took to it like a fish in water.
So you've got this whole like, so you come up, you're in this dispensational look. You're on the mission field out there meeting. So there's no comfort zone in the mission field, right? So you're out in this culture. Then you come back, your mom and dad are still teaching. They're still taking you around. And then you get exposed to this massive amount of difference. First, the Reformed theology from the Presbyterian, the PCA, and your parents are really busy doing what they're doing. And then you're at the Summit Ministries. And then you're, like you just said, there's this wide variety of people. So you're getting very cultured in the Christian world, like from so many different perspectives.
I look back at it as a very formative experience, mm-hmm. because where I grew up in the churches that we grew up, we didn't do politics. We didn't hold hands with other denominations. We were to keep the pure faith.
Yes.
Right. So it was a formative experience when you realize that there are people with completely different concepts of theology and doctrine, mm-hmm. who love God, who are obviously followers of Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. and who want to make a difference in this world, mm-hmm. for the gospel. It was like a train wreck.
Yeah.
From my background. And I'm only a teenager, and I'm trying to mull this over because I'm in, you know, the altar calls are every Sunday,
right.
at the Baptist church, you know, save souls, get out there, be soul winner. How many souls have you won this week? Mm-hmm. And you're knocking on doors, and how many tracts have you passed out?
Right.
So you go from that mentality to a cultural sort of milieu of different ideas about how to live in the long term, especially with the American scene that we have currently, you know, the culture that's degraded,
right.
Since the 1980s, especially from my formative years. You know, the homeschooling movement was all the whole idea of you can make a change in culture by teaching your children at home, mm-hmm. keep them out of the government schools. So it was almost messianic. In that idea.
Sure.
It was the solution, you know, worldview stuff. So it was like the next step. So at Summit Ministries, James Dobson's son, Ryan, mm-hmm. went there that's how he got big, is James Dobson's son, Ryan, basically had a conversion experience at this place. And so Focus on the Family was pushing Summit Ministries. So one of the years I got to work with Ryan Dobson at the main campus in Magic Springs, we got to meet a whole bunch of other, you know, bigwigs, mm-hmm. in the Christian right movement. We talked about politics. We had speakers that were involved in the Reagan administration, mm-hmm. previously. So that was like my formative experience of late teens and early 20s.
Yeah.
And,
So ranging all the way from homeschool up to the highest places in government.
It interacting with people, rubbing shoulders with people that had that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. Yes. And making relationships and friendships and learning from people and their experience from a very young age. And this is where it ties into some of my work, because one of the very last things at Summit Ministries for my first year working there in 1992 was a creation science mini conference for 1 week. Hosting Henry Morris and John Morris, mm, okay. of the Institute for Creation Research. Mm-hmm. So Dr. David Noble was a big young earth creationist at the time, although Summit Ministries was going a different direction when I was there, and I could see a lot of dialogue about this creation issue and how big that is in the Christian worldview stuff. Well, I was there at Summit Ministries the last time that they had an ICR mini conference during the summer.
Wow, okay.
So I got to sit around the table with Henry Morris and John Morris and ask them questions and talk to them, because I was huge, because this was Christian worldview stuff, right?
Sure.
Creationism is like the bomb, mm-hmm. in that world. It is the solution to all of secularism and all of the cultural rot. You know, you have the answer for why there's sin in the world. You have the answer for why we have you know, family structure the way we have. You have the answer for, you know, where American Christianity went wrong by rejecting the Bible beginning in Genesis 1:1.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my background.
Right.
And
Which is going to make sense when we get later in this interview. It's going to make a lot of sense. This was in your formative years, so it's a very powerful, important moment in your life. So, all right. So you're at the end of your Summit Ministries years, right?
Right.
You're in Colorado.
So I was in Colorado for the summers. Mm-hmm. I was living in South Carolina for the winters.
Right.
And at that time, what I was also reading was Gary DeMar and a lot of the Reconstructionist writers, Gary North, Gary DeMar, Greg Bahnsen. And there was a school starting up in my area in Greenville, South Carolina, called Christ College. Mm-hmm. And I went to an American Vision event that was sort of modeled after the same idea of Summit Ministries in Atlanta, Georgia. It was called the Life Preparation Conference.
Okay.
It was, again, another week-long event where all these students come in. And that's where I met my wife for the first time. Mm-hmm. I met Amy at an American Vision conference. But again, it was that Christian worldview idea. And they were starting a new school. Well, there was a new school that started in Virginia but was moving to South Carolina. And the professors were going to be Greg Bahnsen, Ken Gentry, who was based in Greenville, South Carolina, where I was living. Mm-hmm. And we had started going to the Presbyterian Church where Ken Gentry was pastor at that time. And so I moved into my studies into Reformed theology proper at Christ College with these professors. And so I was getting postmillennialism, I was getting, you know, theonomy, Van Til apologetics, mm-hmm. from like the main leaders.
Right.
And I was there for 2 years. Amy went to Christ College for one of those years as well. We ended up getting engaged by the end of that and moving out and starting a family.
Wow, that's
so
awesome.
That's kind of the direction that we went. But that's where my background with Gary DeMar goes back, you know, into early 1990s. We were reading Last Days Madness, mm-hmm. back when, you know, the first edition, people don't realize this, but the first edition of Last Days Madness made a break in Matthew 24, and there was like this past fulfilled part of Matthew 24, and then there was this future Matthew 24 that's, you know, the second coming, mm-hmm. in the future. But that was back in the early days.
Yeah, there's new revisions to that book.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
And new books.
New books, yeah.
Following up on it.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah, so take us from there. So you've met Amy, you've gotten married, you're beginning to have a family. You're in South Carolina, and she finishes college. You finish college then?
Right. So Amy was from Golden, Colorado, just outside of Denver. So when we got married, we ended up in the Denver metro area for 4 years. And I worked with a friend of mine from the church that we were attending at the time. The pastor there was Max Sotak, and he was somewhat of a controversial figure in the Reformed world, but learned a lot from Max. But we had two children there in the Denver metro area, and I started my first window cleaning business with a fellow in the church who taught me how to do window cleaning business and everything. So things took off very, very well from there. But we were in the Denver metro area for 4 years, and then we moved to Montana in 1999.
Okay.
And had 7 more children.
Yeah. No, I got to meet a lot of them yesterday.
Yeah, that was fun.
And your grandchildren. It kind of reminds me of like Laura Ingalls Wilder's books up here, you know, where it's so rural and big family. You have big, not everybody has a big family, I suppose, but you have a big family, and it's very, your family is so sweet. I didn't see a television anywhere. These kids were running around. If they wanted a snack, they picked a cucumber and just went to eating it. And I was like, this is phenomenal. I love it up here.
Right. Yeah. So as a homeschooler, one of the things that we were able to do is our own independent studies. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I got into was greenhouse growing and organic gardening, mm-hmm. as a teenager. And it was one of the ways that we could make money too, because we had produce stands down at the corner. We could go down there and sell our produce and make our own money. Because when you grow up in that Christian day school culture, there's not a lot of money involved. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're scratching.
That's right.
To make it, you know, any kind of extra money was like awesome for kids growing up in that culture.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So that was kind of my background. And of course, up here with the farm, it's become more of an operation that's a family-based business. Mm-hmm. And we've grown into our niche here with Covenant Gardens.
Right.
And
which I've walked through, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, there's...
And I'm not even seeing it when it's at its, you know, at its height, you know, I'm just right. Seeing, yeah.
So it becomes ministry. We have a family business here with the window cleaning as well, which pays our bills and mm-hmm. funds the operation. But we homeschooled our children. We have one at the high school now. As they get older, they kind of decide what they'd like to do. Mm-hmm. But with a congregation that I was involved in here in Montana, it was a very small country, independent reformational church. You know, we had a lot of homeschoolers because that's really what we emphasized mm-hmm. was the Christian worldview and homeschooling and stuff. And so we had a community center that we used for our meeting place. We also used for like co-oping for homeschool gatherings, and parents would come in and do classes and we'd kind of join up forces for a day or two a week. Mm-hmm. And one of the big questions was, you know, what do you teach your children about, you know, creationism? And stuff, you know, old earth, young earth, all that stuff was discussed. And it was very much emphasized that we have to stay, you know, with what the Bible teaches, mm-hmm. you know, from the literal truth of Scripture from Genesis 1 on. And I had three children at the time, and they were bringing in a group from Answers in Genesis to do like, you know, creation seminar, evening, mm-hmm. daytime thing. And they wanted to use the building at the congregation to have this in Whitehall. And at the time we were elders, we were governed by unanimous vote. Mm-hmm. So if anybody, you know, said no, it basically vetoed the whole thing. And I said, you know, guys, because we're about the kingdom theology, we're about cultural, we're about, you know, applying our faith to all areas of life. I'm not comfortable with bringing them in here because I know what their eschatology is going to be. Mm-hmm. And we were all partial preterists or more mm-hmm. at the time. And I said, I don't really want to, this sort of runs counter to what we're trying to do as a ministry here with the congregation and our homeschooling. And they got very upset about that, because I basically torpedoed the idea of having it in Whitehall. But they had it in a neighboring town in Helena at a different Baptist church. And I didn't go because I was beyond that at that point. I really wasn't interested in teaching my children that view of the Bible, particularly in Genesis, because I knew there's fulfillment aspects that had implications for Noah's flood and different things. So they went to that event. They held it up in Helena, and they came back to me afterwards because there was the altar call. You know, the whole futurism, the world is coming to an end, was all tied into exactly, you know, creation and fall and consummation. Mm-hmm. And it was, the altar call was given. The dispensationalism was just, you know, ubiquitous. Yes. In this group. And they came back to me, the elders came back to me and said, you know, we didn't realize it was going to be that bad.
Yeah.
And that started a conversation in our congregation over the whole issue of origins and Genesis creation and eschatology that is ongoing. And our, you know, the Beyond Creation Science, the book, came out of that congregational struggle mm-hmm. over those issues and what the implications of our worldview theology and our fulfilled eschatology really mean.
So earlier when you said some of us are partial preterists, some of us were more, can you go into that a little bit more? So I would say, let's talk about it from your perspective, like yours and Amy's, as you're studying also personally. So where are you at that time? Are you starting to go more, or are you one of the
So this would have been from the year 2000 to like mid 2000s mm-hmm. range that I'm talking about. So we're talking about, you know, 20 to 24 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was convinced of full preterism, but I was more interested in Reformed theology. Mm-hmm. And so for me at that time, it was more about like, you know, historic Reformed thinking. And then, yeah, sure, we have full preterism. The other people in the church were Reformed in their theology, which means that they had, you know, the confessional position of a future second coming, a future judgment, to wrap up cosmological eschatology. So we were never fully 100% agreed at the congregation, which was fine. And it actually worked out fine because we had a number of people. We had three people that spoke and taught and preached. There was no full-time pastor. You know, it was an elder-based form of government. So we just basically, you know, threw together for ministry and kingdom life and worship and family support in a community, in a Christian community, a local Christian community. So there was a lot of diversity within the congregation. Of course, visitors would come in and they would love the relationship side. They would love the homeschooling side. They love the, you know, the politics, and they love, but this eschatology you're teaching, you know, we just can't go along with that, you know, because they're coming from that fundamentalist background that's very, very futurist. And of course, within the homeschooling movement, you know, you're going to run into that because it comes from that dispensational background as a huge chunk of that background. Homeschooling has gotten bigger than that, so there's other groups, but that was the stream through which we came through it. And that's very, very popular here in this rural environment. In some ways, we joked about it because we're always like, you know, 20 years behind the seminaries. So the guys are here in the 2000s. They were at, you know, being taught 70s and 80s eschatology. And they just stuck with it. LaHaye and, you know, Dallas Theological Seminary and stuff like that.
Well, that's what I just had a... I had an experience. I went to a funeral just recently, and it was of somebody that was only 17 years old, and this entire community had rallied around this family. And what I was expecting was this fundamental look, you know, at what goes beyond death. So I was expecting to hear that he would rise first, that the family who were alive and remain would go, like the things that I'm very used to is what I would, you know, hear. But remarkably, the main person that was speaking never said anything at all in regard to that. He focused instead on the fact that this young man was a believer and that he is with the Lord. He's with the Lord. And that's the most important thing, is that he is with the Lord. And it's hard for us on this end. And I remember thinking, because there were so many people in that congregation that we find comfort in things that we've been taught our whole life, right? We find comfort in that. And so even if that would be Mr. Martin's phone. So whenever, and if you hear the bull in the background, he's been very, very happy this morning. And the sun's rising. It's beautiful here. So my only point of bringing this up is that that's something that I've learned even in my own community and surrounding communities, is that the things that we were taught by the ministers in our area, the things that brought us comfort, they were fraught with the, like, kind of weird theology. Some of it's weird eschatology, even, you know, even for us, it was bizarre. But there was still a lot of comfort here in this old pastor just talking about it from a basic sense, which is to see things as, well, he's with the Lord. That's what's important, you know? And so I only bring that up just because it rocked our family. And I find a lot of comfort in some of those old things that they say. Like, you know, we're going to split. I'm not looking for a hole in the ground. I'm looking for a hole in the sky. You know, the idea, you know, and you long for that. You're like, yeah, that's where I want to be with the Lord. And so you feel that. But it's good when you can stop and rethink these basic fundamental things that we have. Just like you said, the Dallas Theological Seminary has impacted our culture massively, you know.
Right. There's the book from Hummel, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism. And I read that recently when it was first released, and it was like filled in so many blanks about my own thinking about, you know, 20th century background, what was going on before I was born that impacted my life, and then the journey since then, mm-hmm. and rethinking things and, you know, tossing things. And
I actually got a chance to interview him. He's a great guy, Dr. Dan Hummel. Read that book, Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, to really give you a good understanding of our culture.
So that's my background. From here, I'm more focused on, you know, family responsibilities, and I would like to do some more research and writing as we go. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the full preterist movement because I think that there's a tremendous amount of potential for that, mm-hmm. not just within theology, but actually the cultural outworking of the implications of that. Mm-hmm. But I think we are struggling with the what now question and culture, mm-hmm. within preterism. I think that leads to a lot of the friction from different groups, mm-hmm. as far as where they see the future going. Mm-hmm. We're living in a culture that's disintegrating as well. Mm-hmm. So that wider culture puts a lot of pressure on people to, you know, it's easy just to go back into those known old paths way, mm-hmm. as the solution. And I think that God calls us to something more than that, in his providence, in his kingdom reign, to calls us to something that's going to be more mature in the future than it's been in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's really the basic idea of my thinking.
Yeah, and I've been asking myself the same question, like what exactly is disintegrating, right? So for us, we grew up in a culture, you know, you had a pretty big Christian culture. Morality was based on this Christian worldview. Right. You know, prior to these devices like cell phones and things, we were a little bit more community-based. We talked about this yesterday.
Right.
That social media has literally destroyed social media. We should just social construct. Like, we're looking at little devices instead of interacting with one another. That's what I loved about your farm yesterday. It's like, there were no cell phones hanging out. Like, everybody was just talking and around each other, and life was going.
You missed the volleyball game after you left.
I did. Yeah, I was too tired. I was jet lagged. No, but I did miss that. So you guys played some volleyball after. Yeah. I saw your son throw a football. It was a tight spiral and it looked like it went about 70 yards. I was like, who is this kid? But no, I think I agree with you. I think that we were talking about this right before we started recording about sandbox theology, the idea that we can sit down in a sandbox and be creative and try to think inside that sandbox and build these little constructs and look at things from different points of view. And I would say that you are one of those people that have got in the sandbox and you've really started looking at things, especially in regard to Genesis, because we're so focused in eschatology, that's the study of the future things or the end times or whatever you want to call it. And you're saying, okay, that's fine. We're looking at the end and you're using a particular hermeneutic to do so. What if we turn that backwards and we looked at the beginning? What does that mean? And
right.
that has been fascinating to me too.
Well, any kind of standard theology, mm-hmm. whether it be systematic or biblical theology, is going to tell you that Genesis and Revelation are connected. Mm-hmm. This is not debatable.
Right.
We have thousands of years of Christian theology that drew the association between that which was in the beginning and that which will be, mm-hmm. at the end. Mm-hmm. So I don't really feel like I'm inventing anything new.
Right.
I'm working within that historic context. And I think a lot of preterists should do that more, actually, mm-hmm. because what they would rather do is say, okay, we have now fulfillment, and we will just make up whatever new theology we want, mm-hmm. with this and keep all the old stuff that we want. And it becomes very pick and choose. Yeah, it becomes very arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And you realize people have different traditions that they're coming from, so they have different emotional attachments to various doctrines.
Right.
And so you have this thing where you have, like, I always use the imagery of, like, you have somebody, theologically speaking, as a symbol, they're like dressed in a tux up top, but mm-hmm. then they're like in athletic shorts.
Right.
It's like, yeah. It's like, that doesn't match that. But that's okay. You don't know that yet. You know, this is the best you're doing. This is the best you know. This is, you're new to this. You're new to thinking through these. And I told my co-author, Jeff Vaughn, the other day, I think there's a lot of preterists are like walking cabinets, cupboards, of various self-contradictory items that they don't even know the implications of various things. That's fine.
Yeah.
You know? So we're all working through that sort of systematization. And I would rather work within the context of established Christian theology that understands there is a connection between the beginning and the end. And I appreciate historic Christian theology. Mm-hmm. That was my training. That's my background. And I think there's a lot to learn from that, even if we think that, you know, the fulfillment of all things has implications that make it obsolete. Mm-hmm. We can still learn from historical Christian theology in tremendous ways. And yes, there may be some things that need to be translated or worked on, developed within that full preterist paradigm. And that's really kind of been my focus.
Mm-hmm.
To develop that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different people within this preterist movement, like you said, these little cabinets that walk through and maybe aren't aware of the implications of some of the things that they're saying.
Right.
And that's, I think that's understandable. The part that the Burroughs have had issues with, that I personally have had issues with, is this drastic division and almost like a point of hatred. I'm showing air quotes here, hatred, like the idea of pointing out someone else and saying, look, you've broken from orthodoxy. And it's like, dude, the full preterist is definitely a break from orthodoxy. So that's like calling the kettle black.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is a third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outstanding option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
Right. And I think our culture is in a very awkward stage. Preterism is happening within the wider culture. And we have basically institutions that are failing, ideas that have failed. And we're in this transition period of time where people are willing to look at other options and other answers and other alternatives. But really what comes next as far as institutional, like, cohesion has not appeared yet. And so I see preterists as they're the ones who have already gone through this transition in their own personal studies. And they realize the bankruptcy of certain paradigms that they come from. And now they want to investigate and study new things. And I appreciate that because that's been my history as well. And trying to be balanced is the hard part because you can either, you know, accept everything in your past without question on one side, or on the other extreme, reactionary extreme, you can throw it all away and throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Sure,
as that concept. So I really think that disciplined thinking and study of God's word can produce a new alternative, a theology that makes sense. An eschatology that is not self-contradictory to Christian worldview, to itself, to cultural outreach and things. But it's going to take time, and it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of patience. It's going to take discussions, sometimes debates, to get there, because I think all of those different aspects contribute to, you know, finding those kinds of, you know, solutions.
In my opinion, the ramifications of this eschatological view, especially full preterism, what that means, like, okay, fine, you guys have been in the sandbox for decades, you're working this stuff out, that's wonderful, you're still doing that. But then the onus comes on that group once they fully develop, or they develop it, then you have to get it out of the sound box and you have to put it into practice. It's no longer prototyping.
Right.
Now it's into production. So we talk about this disintegrating culture that we're in. We're looking at it from an American culture, maybe not the world, but just American, maybe the world too. I don't know. I'm not outside the United States all that often, but it seems to me like we're at the phase now where we're going to have to start injecting into the culture, because there are some groups, like I said, when I got in the airport getting ready to fly here, in the inspirational section, there were books about this. Are you living at the end of the world? Are you living in the end times? These are books that are still selling on the shelf in the public for everyone to see. And by the way, I didn't see any Full Preterist books. I didn't see any Partial Preterist books. I didn't see Gary DeMar's Last Days Madness there. I didn't see any alternative view. So even in the mainstream, in our little Asheville airport, and we're in a very liberal section of the state. We're a blue community in a red, you know, mostly red state. So to see those things, we're going to have to inject this into the culture at some point. It has to be done, because if it's not, you're going to continue to see this degrading, because a lot. Now, Sarita Edgerton in our group is one of the rarities who is a futurist who is absolutely out there. She's not talking about it. She's the doer, right? Which is awesome. But that's not true for a lot of us. There's a lot of us that, yeah, we're doing it in our homes and in our families, and that's where it starts.
Right.
But it's got to get outside.
Right. And for me, you know, I think the kingdom of God works through God's people. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be an organic, natural outworking of the ministries that you do, whether it be through your vocation, through your community volunteering, through your interests, etc. For us, it was the farming. Mm-hmm. It has been a huge door opening in regenerative agriculture, which there's a whole new way of thinking about growing and producing food for humans that is intriguing, because it's a long-term view being applied to agriculture. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, well, just take whatever you can get right now and don't worry about the future.
Sure.
So
we've seen what that does to our lands.
It is extraordinarily destructive. Mm-hmm. Both on an environmental sense, but also in human health. Mm-hmm. We're going to be paying that price for the next couple generations. Mm-hmm. Because it's too late to go wind the clock back. Mm-hmm. 40, 50, 60 years, or even 100 years to get back to where we were. But that's, to me, that matches preterist eschatology. Mm-hmm. Regenerative agriculture is like applying preterist theology to agriculture. Mm-hmm. In many ways. And I could explain the nuance of that in a technical sense, where community is very important. Diversity is health. Mm-hmm. In the regenerative agricultural paradigm. Mm-hmm. You know, in Christian community, we now see that we need each other. Mm-hmm. We need those different perspectives to check ourselves, for one thing. So you're not growing out of control. Mm-hmm. You know, with your ideology and becoming destructive with your ideology. We need each other to, because we have different strengths. Mm-hmm. Right?
Sure.
So there's this theology there, and there's this practical outworking in the culture that I see a lot of parallels to. And for me, you know, in my local area in Southwest Montana, it opens the door to conversation with people that don't generally identify as Christians, because they tend to be the granola types. They tend to be the lefties, right? The foodies.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, they're the ones that want to have, you know, more laws about pollution and more laws about, you know, certain land issues. Mm-hmm. And how farmers and ranchers operate to be less destructive. Of course, that creates friction. Mm-hmm. With the old school of I do what I want with my property.
That's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Which, if you think about it, you know, when you start talking about loving your neighbor as yourself, there's more to it than just me, myself, and I.
Yes.
And my property. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a Christian idea too.
That's right.
So is it always the idea that, you know, Christians vote a particular political way? I have come to rethink that whole idea. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming at this from a background immersed in hardcore right-wing Republican,
yeah,
conservative
sure,
moral majority type thinking.
Right.
But my experience and my beliefs and my study of scripture forces me to think wider.
Yeah, it's look, I'm not an anti-Trump person by any stretch. I'm a conservative.
We're in Trump country right now. This is Trump country.
Yeah, and you know, as far as Republican versus Democrat and all that, but I guess when we use the terms like "let's make America great again," you know, which part? Like, which part of America? What are you talking about? Are you talking about the way that the way that we used to farm? How about during the Dust Bowl, the way that we treated the land out in, you know, the breadbasket of America and just absolutely destroyed it? And, you know, it changed that culture there drastically. I don't know if you're ever familiar with the Dust Bowl.
I understand the plow techniques that went into creating that situation and making a drought situation much worse.
Yes, much worse.
Displaced families. And
so is that when America was great? Because that's what a lot of people think back in that time frame. I think that to say make America great again, or, you know, I think that our view... the way that we treat each other in the apprentice community, I would say no. Let's not inject that into society because we're all bickering.
Right.
But let's talk about what the implications of fulfillment mean and what you're living in now. And let's have open dialogue to talk about how, like, you as a farmer are going to love your neighbor. How does that work?
Well, I think it's even more direct than that, because I think really my conclusion at this point is where I'm thinking right now is the best way to be a healthy influence in your country is to recenter yourself in the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
Where
that's
the
really
politics
good, yes.
The politics comes along as a side effect mm-hmm. of that. You bring health to a culture by centering yourself on Jesus Christ and his reign. And the kingdom of God and the principles of that going out to the world around you. And, you know, that's really how America got great anyway. It wasn't based on who they elected as president. It had to do with the cultural beliefs of the people and the ingenuity that came from that and the discipline that came from that and the productivity that came from that. And so in a lot of ways, you know, the political scene is trying to get the results without the source.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where my criticism of that whole thing goes. So our job is to put the kingdom of God first. Mm-hmm. You know, seek first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added to you.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I think we've gotten so involved in the politics that we've been distracted and sort of wooed away to what we think of as being more powerful politically defined,
mm-hmm.
and missing out on where the real true power is.
And I would say Gary DeMar agrees with you on that, because his God and Government, when you get into that, you see how you work. It's the self and the home, right. And then out into the community. I agree. I think it starts really with us, but then it gets into our families and our communities. And
I'm really eclectic. Mm-hmm. Because I think that is true from the right-wing perspective. That is sort of the ideas. But then at the same time, I see other perspectives that, to me, embody or incarnate the gospel even more,
mm-hmm.
that aren't always viewed as, like, consistent with that.
Mm-hmm.
So where that goes, I don't really know, and I don't really want to, you know, bind people's conscience,
sure.
about things. But I think the central issue is when we recenter Jesus Christ and the gospel and the kingdom of God as our goal in life,
mm-hmm.
you know, as God's people.
Right.
You know, you don't really, the idea of being an American pales in comparison.
Absolutely.
To who you are in your identity in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And part of God's people that goes back thousands of years with this long history, mm-hmm. as a church. We are the one holy people and nation of God.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really get that, you know, American politics, okay.
Yeah.
We can do that.
Yeah.
But there's a bigger story.
It's down on the bottom of the tree.
Right.
Like, you got a nice little tree and it's down here.
It's priorities.
Yes, absolutely. So where do you see yourself going? Obviously, we haven't talked about your book, but we're going to be having some roundtable discussions. I'm sure that'll come up. Did you want to mention anything in regard to your book or your website that our audience could learn more about?
Everything pretty much is archived on beyondcreationscience.com, where we investigate the connection between eschatology and protology.
Mm-hmm.
You can access all the material there.
Yeah.
So that's all. Beyondcreationscience.com.
Okay. yeah, go there, guys. It's a fascinating archive. There's a lot of information. How long have you been working on that website?
We put the website up when we published the third edition in 2007.
Okay.
But the first edition was 2001, where we really began. And Jeff was involved after the first edition, mm-hmm. From 2002 or 2003. Mm-hmm. My co-author, Jeff Vaughn, was involved. And then I asked him to be co-author on the third edition because mm-hmm. he brought so much to the project.
I need to meet him. I haven't met him. I'm friends with him on Facebook, but I haven't met him. I'd like to meet him. So, all right. Well, as we wrap this up, I want to ask you the question Billy Kimsey always asks everybody. So when you take your last breath here on Earth, where do you go?
Yeah, that it's always a fun question to ask preterists.
Yeah.
Because we look at the Bible so differently.
Yes.
My fundamental belief is that God's people are God's treasure.
Okay.
And I don't believe that our God is the kind of God that throws away his treasure. Mm-hmm. So I believe that we go into God's presence directly. But at the same time, I have to say that I believe that we can't imagine the experience of after death. Mm-hmm. And I don't really believe the Bible speaks about the details of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. So I think that we are now, as preterists, we're forced to actually look at post-mortem experience completely by faith. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the whole point of life. Mm-hmm. Can you get into discipleship of Jesus Christ through a lifetime of service in the kingdom mm-hmm. and learn to say, I don't know what it's going to be like, but I believe it'll be fine.
As you're sitting here telling me this, the sun is beginning to rise over the mountain, overlooking this beautiful landscape. And the bull is, you know, waking us all up over here. And to think that this would pale in comparison to the things. But this is beautiful. This is incredible. And it's my opinion that he's an impressive creator. My goodness. Well, Tim Martin, thanks so much for being on the Burrows of Berea.
Thanks, Rick.
Yep. Thanks for bringing me up here. I'm looking forward to these talks that we have with you and Steve Magua from the Ask the Pastor series. I'm super excited. So I appreciate you, Tim.
Thank you, Rick.
Let's keep doing it.
Absolutely.
All right, brother.
Hey, guys. This is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. A lot of people have been asking us, hey, what is this Patreon thing? Our old Patreon ad didn't work very well. So here you go, guys. Go to www.patreon. That is patreon.com. Let me do that again. patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea. If you go to the Patreon page, you will find that we have different levels that you can give at. We have a $3 level, a $5 level. We've got a $10 level and a $20 level. I thought about putting a $1,000 level there, but you never know how that's going to work out, right, Andy? That's right. So go to www.patreon.com/TheBurrowsofBerea and give us all of your money.
even a little bit will be fine.
Yeah. And that $5,000 wouldn't hurt
nobody. No, it would hurt nobody.
Thanks, guys.